This is Age Well with Dr. Sophie Schotter. And this is a conversation with Dr. Will Balsowitz, one of the world's leading experts on gut health. A quick note to say that this episode assumes everyone listening has a baseline understanding of the gut microbiome, so we're not too focused on what you probably already know. We drill down into a few other things. Have a listen to this clip.
Do probiotics work? Absolutely. I'm quite sure there are listeners who will raise their hand right now and be like, yeah, they worked for me. They helped me. Do for some people they not work? Yeah, same would be true. I'm sure listeners are like, yeah, but I tried them and they didn't work. The key here is that we have to find the...
We also talk about the incredible new data on one type of food.
I've been studying medicine since 2002. And in all these years of my study, these are by far the most anti-inflammatory thing that I've ever come across.
We also talk about what goes on in the bathroom and why and how we should all be pooping.
And that's why our poop matters. We should be looking at it.
We get some great fun facts on the vaginal microbiome.
The vaginal microbiome undergoes a shift.
Will has so many great tips.
I think that they're a superfood.
And some incredible, invaluable, possibly life-saving advice.
If we simply fixed this particular issue, we would be so much healthier.
We think everyone needs to hear this episode, so please go ahead, share it, and let's all start making some of the changes that you're about to hear. Thanks for listening. So today we're talking to Dr. Will Balsowitz, aka Dr. V. Will is a doctor, an award-winning gastroenterologist, a researcher, an entrepreneur, a New York Times best-selling author, adjunct assistant professor of medicine at the Emory School of Medicine, and medical director with the team at Zoe. In short, he is a globally renowned expert on gut health and digestive disease, as well as the recipient of multiple awards, and also someone who's contributed to over 20 published articles. But Will is also a man on a mission to help people improve their gut health through the power of plants, specifically fiber, but more on that in a moment. And if you're thinking, oh, the gut health conversation is so done, I promise you, you won't have had a gut health conversation like this one. So in this chat, we'll be talking to Will about everything from probiotics and healthy bathroom habits through to new data on cancer therapeutics. Plus, stay with us for advice on what you can do right now to radically improve your gut health in ways that maybe you might not have expected. It's the kind of advice that ordinarily you'd be paying thousands of dollars for. Just to say, you can buy Will's books through all the usual channels, the New York Times bestselling Fiber Fueled and the Fiber Fueled Cookbook. There's also stacks of great info on his website, theplantfedgut.com. And because he's completely oversubscribed with the private clients, you can also buy Will's courses online. So do look into those. Finally, and not surprisingly, Dr. Will has a huge social following. You can find him on TikTok, Insta, and Facebook at The Gut Health MD. Will lives in Charleston, South Carolina with his wife and children. Will, welcome to Age Well.
Thank you so much for having me. That's quite an introduction. And we have to add nerd to the list because clearly I'm a nerd.
We're both nerds too, so you're in good company here.
Okay, good. I like that. We can nerd out then.
With the microbiome, I think it would be really great if you can kind of bring it to life a little bit for us, what it actually is, and also the scale of these microbes we discussed, because of course it goes so far beyond just bacteria, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. And I think the word life is the appropriate way to describe this because it is alive, and it's quite hard for us as humans to conceptualize or understand what we're even really talking about, to be honest, because it's invisible to the naked eye. But if for a moment with the listeners, we pretended that we had a microscope and we pull out this microscope, we're going to take a look. We're going to zoom in on this world that exists as a part of our body, covering all external surfaces from the top of our head to the tip of our toes, inside our nose, inside our mouth, throughout our intestines, inside a woman's vagina, even covering our own eyeball. And we just can't see them, thankfully. So, because that would be quite distracting if I saw them scurrying across my eye as we were talking here. Nonetheless, there are 39 trillion microbes. The word microbe refers to the fact that these are microscopic organisms. And they form a community mostly focused inside our colon, where you'll find the vast majority of these microbes. It includes bacteria and fungi and parasites and these things called archaea that I'm obsessed with. I think they're really cool and interesting. And even, so this number 39 trillion does not include viruses. We actually think there's a quadrillion. So if you think a trillion wow. and then multiply by 1,000, we think there's a quadrillion viruses. So in all of this, lives in harmony inside of us, mostly focused inside of our colon, the large intestine. And it's like almost a parallel universe to our world is that we see and that we live on a daily basis. Because inside of us, again, if we have that microscope and we zoom in, what you would see looks a bit like life on Earth, in that these microorganisms, like mostly bacteria, they have circles of friends, like they have cliques, they have people that they work with, they have specific jobs that they do, they have unique skill sets. They're not all good at the same stuff. Certain microbes do certain things really well, but are not able to do other things. They have different dietary preferences. They don't all like kale, believe it or not. And the last and certainly not least is they love to procreate. So they're much like us humans.
You've published two incredible books. They're both bestsellers, so congratulations on that. But just to quote you back at you, you once said, and I am paraphrasing here, I believe that fiber is the single most important missing piece in the Western diet. Thanks to that, I'm becoming a fiber nerd, by the way. Thanks to you. So why fiber? And if you can also join the dots between fiber and also these short-chain fatty acids.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to call that paraphrasing anymore if we don't want to. I will gladly accept the statement, I believe fiber is the single most important missing piece in the Western diet. I think that's 100% true. And if we simply fixed the fiber deficiency, which, by the way, is widely prevalent in both the United States and the UK, if we simply fixed this particular issue, we would be so much healthier. And I want to prove that. But before I prove that, let me just explain why fiber is so important, because it's very different than the fiber that I knew as a kid, the fiber that I knew in college or in medical school or even as a doctor. There's new science. And what we've discovered is that there's this special unique quality to fiber, which is that we as humans lack the enzymes to break down and digest it, which basically means that it will survive digestion, make its way all the way through our roughly 8 meters of intestines, and arrive in the colon, where it comes into contact with this community of 38 trillion microbes that are focused there. And this becomes their food. Fiber becomes their food. And the enzymes that we lack as humans, like we literally don't have them, these microbes, they have them in spades, meaning tens of thousands of unique enzymes specifically for the purpose of breaking down the complexity that exists within fiber. And when they do this, it's a magical thing, because fiber stops being fiber. It undergoes this metamorphosis. And when it reemerges, it's something different. Like, you don't see it the same. Now we call it a short chain fatty acid. Mm-hmm. The fiber gets broken down into little pieces. It's not even a carbohydrate anymore. Now it's a fat. And these little pieces, we hear them in the scientific literature as acetate, propionate, and butyrate. These are the short chain fatty acids, and these are, I've been studying science since 1998. I've been studying medicine since 2002. And in all these years of my study, these are by far the most anti-inflammatory thing that I've ever come across. And we get them from the consumption of fiber, and they have healing effects throughout our entire body. And they are a manifestation of the fact that fiber comes into contact with our gut microbiome. They are literally proof of our symbiotic relationship that we have with these microbes. And my favorite, this is where I get to share my favorite fiber study of all time, which was published by Professor Andrew Reynolds, who's from New Zealand. And basically his goal was to compile all of the available evidence for dietary fiber, meaning fiber that's in our diet from eating plant foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grain seeds, nuts, and legumes, all the available evidence. And what is the effect on normal people? Not necessarily people who are very sick, but just normal people. Like, you could be perfectly healthy. What's fiber going to do for you? And when they compile this evidence in a systematic review and meta-analyses, like basically to remove all the bias, here's what they found. People who consume more fiber live longer, less likely to have a heart attack, less likely to die of heart disease, less likely to have a stroke, less likely to be diagnosed with multiple forms of cancer that include colorectal cancer, breast cancer, esophageal cancer. By the way, like colorectal cancer, number two cause of cancer death in the United States. I'm quite sure that's the same in the UK. Breast cancer, biggest cancer threat to women that exists. And here we are, and we're saying that we could reduce our exposure to these risks by simply increasing our fiber intake. People who consume more fiber are less likely to die from cancer, less likely to be diagnosed with diabetes. In randomized controlled trials, people who consume more fiber, they lose weight, they lower their blood pressure, they lower their cholesterol, they improve their blood sugar control. I have just listed four of the top 10 causes of death in the United States in the last couple moments. These are the same top 10 causes of death in the UK, four of the top 10, that we would substantially improve if we just increased our fiber intake. And the reason why is not because fiber sweeps through us. That's the old story of fiber. The reason why is this new story of fiber, this new science that says that fiber comes into contact with microbes, and the result of that connection is the production of short-chain fatty acids that have anti-inflammatory properties that allow us to heal throughout our entire body. That's an amazing and exciting thing.
I love the pace at which science is evolving and changing and how we're learning constantly. And with the short-chain fatty acids, I know it's now possible to get them as supplement brands. And I was just wondering what your views on that are.
I am an outcomes-driven person. So I ultimately just want to do whatever is necessary to improve my health or to improve the lives and health of people that I work with, such as patients or people who read my books or listen to a podcast of mine. And to me, the way that we accomplish that is by optimizing our diet and optimizing our lifestyle, and then asking the question, are there supplements that can make me even better? And when necessary and appropriate, taking medicines. So to me, I feel like these conversations, people get into their little silo of it's only diet. That's not true.
No, this is where Western medicine's got it the wrong way around.
Medicine's got the wrong way around because to them, it's only pills and procedures, and they ignore diet. We should not ignore options that can make us healthier. It should be all hands on deck for health. So in that regard, I do believe in supplements, and this is the reason why I launched a company called 38 Terra that creates the gut health supplements that I always wished were on the market. Now, if the question is specifically around butyrate or butyrate type supplements, the issue from my perspective is that we have to look at the way in which butyrate behaves. So it's not the same to ingest butyrate as it is to ingest fiber or resistant starch and then allow that fiber or resistant starch to be transformed into butyrate by our microbes that live 7 or 8 meters further down the intestine than where our mouth is. And so if a person takes a butyrate supplement, it gets absorbed almost instantly. And it gets into the blood, but we don't really know what happens from there because that's not the way that it works when people get butyrate by consuming fiber and resistant starch. Whereas when we consume fiber and resistant starch, the butyrate is delivered to the place where we need it, which is in the colon. And actually, the majority of butyrate gets absorbed by our colon cells right there. And it turns into actually their source of energy. So like the majority of energy from our colon cells comes from short-chain fatty acids. So basically, from my perspective, if studies start to emerge that show me that I can lean into butyrate supplements in the same way that I could lean into fiber or resistant starch, I would be completely on board. But until that day exists, I don't believe in making the assumption that butyrate in its like finalized form taken as a supplement is the same as consuming more fiber or resistant starch.
Makes complete sense. So where does the plant-based ethos come into that? And what should we be eating?
It's just eating more plants. All plants contain fiber, all of them. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, seeds, nuts, and legumes. And the diet that actually has the most evidence, by far, is the Mediterranean diet.
Yeah.
And that is not a vegan diet.
I think the last few years, veganism almost became a trend for a while. And from the ethical standpoint, I think it can become quite overwhelming, especially in the social media space, some of the conversations around it. And as you say, the health aspect of simply eating more plants, that message can be lost sometimes.
I think that sometimes like we lose sight of what's important. And so, for example, I see a lot of fighting within the whole food plant-based world that I exist in. I see a lot of fighting over like, is extra virgin olive oil healthy or not healthy? It's like we're completely losing sight of what matters here, which is that at the end of the day, like if people are eating mostly plants, then whether or not they have some extra virgin olive oil or not is not the principal determinant of their health. And so this whole idea of like a pure, perfect diet, forget perfect. None of us are perfect. I'm not perfect. Let's just try to eat more plants and be happy and support one another.
I think it's also really great to be reminded that plants aren't just fruits and vegetables. They're in many things. So I think people need to hear that message as well.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And it's also, and I was, funny enough, I was listening to a Tim Spector podcast last night, and he was reminding us, as he always does so brilliantly, it's not just about being plant-based, it's about the diversity of plants. In the UK, it's recommended we eat 30 grams of fiber a day. In the US, I think that figure is 25 to 30 grams. We were wondering, how many grams of fiber a day do you eat?
I have no clue. To be totally honest with you, I have no clue.
Because, more than that though, right?
So here's the thing. We do set these fiber thresholds, and even myself, I reference them all the time. And I'm quite sure I will be referencing them in the minutes to come after I say this right now. But I think to Tim's point, and it's the same point that I've made for many years now, that it's not about achieving a certain number of grams and then calling it a day. Mm. It's about the overall quality of your diet. And when you add more plants to your diet, you are increasing the variety, and variety becomes this thing that translates on so many levels in terms of ensuring that your body has the vitamins, the minerals, the phytochemicals, the polyphenols, the fiber, the resistant starch, all these wonderful things that we get from plants. When we eat a variety, we don't have to worry about, is there enough of this amino acid? Is there enough of that? Variety takes care of all of those things, evens it out, makes it easy for us basically to accomplish what we need from a nutritional perspective. And then it translates into a more diverse microbiome because these, as I mentioned earlier, these microbes, they have specific dietary preferences. They don't all love the same thing. So when we eat a wide variety of plants, we are thereby feeding a wide variety of microbes. We create a more diverse microbiome, a more diverse ecosystem, and that is a more resilient ecosystem that is capable of holding up. So to me, what I say stop counting grams of fiber, start counting plants. Stop counting calories, start counting plants. Like this is where I'm at.
Yeah. When it comes to fiber, there is a slight paradox that I've heard you talk about. So we know about the importance of fiber, but you've also talked about the importance of not radically changing your diet overnight and suddenly adding in loads and loads of fiber. Because I can imagine people listening to this podcast will suddenly be like, right, that's it. Tonight, dinner's completely changed. But of course, that's not what people should be doing, which is a paradox. And I'm guessing this is to do with the fact that for me, I have in the past avoided beans because they've caused me real stomach pain. And in fact, when I've listened to you talk before on podcasts, I have done exactly what I've just mentioned. I've had a hugely fibrous meal. And then the next day, my tummy's in real pain. Can you talk to us about that?
Don't be mad at me. I'm sorry that that happens. This used to happen to me too. Years ago, I couldn't eat beans either because it would cause me a lot of discomfort and pain. And I think that the key that I want to relay is that I want people to think of their gut like it's a muscle. It's a muscle that is exercised when we consume fiber, and it can grow stronger. And if we take this analogy and we take it to the gym, it starts to make a lot of sense, which is that if you go to the gym and it's January 1st and you haven't been working out and you go a little too hard, it hurts. And that could be temporary soreness that lasts for a couple days, maybe a week or two. You could also like really hurt yourself if you just go beyond the limits of what your body is capable of doing. So what is the right approach to introducing exercise into our life? Well, you start with an amount that you're actually capable of doing. And by doing that amount, you are working within the constructs of your functionality, like your capabilities. But then you start to enhance your capabilities. The muscles become more functional, more powerful, more capable of endurance, all of these different qualities, depending on what type of exercise that you're doing. And so then you start to do more. You're able to increase.
Yeah.
So this is the way that it works in the gym, and it's so intuitive and obvious to us. So we take advantage of this on a routine basis. This is why we all believe in exercise. Yet when it comes to our gut, it doesn't seem like it's as intuitive and obvious to people. But when your gut is not trained to eat a specific food, such as beans, you know, the thing about beans, I think that they're a superfood. But the challenge or the issue is that they're extremely high in fiber and resistant starch, which are the components that we are 100% reliant on our microbes to help us to process and digest. And so because we are so reliant on our microbes to do that, if your gut is not in a good place, it's quite easy to overwhelm your body with too many beans. And then you feel it and you don't feel well. And then you think that beans are not the answer. The answer is to consume an amount of beans that you're actually capable of consuming. And for some people, that's quite a bit. And for some people, that's not very much. Whatever that is, that's who you are. Yeah. And then you just increase from there.
And I think another thing from, again, a medical standpoint that really does worry me is the diet industry. And I know that in your book, In Fiber Fueled, you talk about some of the diets you'd like to see eradicated. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, because low fat, low carb, I still remember growing up in a household very much influenced by the low fat culture, with my mum really believing she was doing the right thing by cooking a relatively low fat diet. And then over the years, the amount of times I've been exposed to low carb and specific food groups being villainized.
Yeah, I think the idea of villainizing an entire macronutrient is kind of insane to me. The healthiest diets are sustainable, number one. You have to be able to actually eat that way. It can't be so restrictive that you're going to bail within 1 to 3 months. The healthiest diets are delicious. And the healthiest diets have the evidence to support that they can make you healthier. And if we were to take those three criteria, sustainable, evidence-based, and delicious, it tends to guide us in a general direction, but it gives us lots of options. And it kind of goes back to the conversation that we were having earlier about there being this big umbrella, which is the plant-based world. And under this big umbrella that is plant-based, I could easily include, happily include, the Mediterranean diet, a flexitarian diet, vegetarian diet of many forms, a vegan diet that's predominantly plant-based, not junk food vegan, a pescatarian diet. So as you can see, like, these are all healthful diets and they're all an option. And to me, like, when we scare people away from specific foods, we restrict their diet, and that doesn't lead us in a healthier place. So I feel like the whole diet industry, look, it's been a problem. It's not just the last 15 years. It's been a problem for far longer than that. But I think it's been amplified by social media. And I think that what happens is people are attracted to what is sexy, what is in vogue at the moment. There's an emotional aspect to these choices that we make. And what ends up being left at the wayside is this stuff that actually is the most proven by science, because it never becomes the trendy, sexy thing. So I'm doing my best to try to change that if I can.
One thing that I do think is quite sexy is telomeres.
You're blushing, Sophie. You're blushing.
I do. And so for anyone who hasn't heard us talk about telomeres before, or who doesn't know what they are, they're the kind of the protective caps on the ends of our chromosomes that protect our genetic material. And I always think the best analogy is that those plastic caps that we have on shoelaces. And these are so important in terms of how our genes are expressed, how they're protected as we age. And we know that they shorten with age, but we also know that this can be accelerated through lifestyle choices that we make. And I know that you have said that fiber is the only dietary approach that has been shown to lengthen our telomeres. So I'd love to hear a bit more about that, about the link between fiber in our diets and telomeres and aging.
Yeah, so the telomeres are, and my apologies for pronouncing it slightly differently. I think it's the American
tomato,
in me.
Tomato.
The aubergine comes in and then I get totally confused. But anyway, the thing about telomeres is that it's like a biological age, right? It doesn't actually tell you precisely when you're going to pass away. I mean, no one knows that. No one has a crystal ball. But in a way, it gives you a sense of where you are. And I think we can all see that, particularly for me. I'm in my 40s now. And like, you can quite clearly see that by the time you get into your 40s, some people are aging at a different pace than others. And if you were to look under the hood and examine this particular metric, it would give you insights into a person's biological age. And what they have shown through research is that there's actually a specific, because it's DNA base pairs that are there. And so these DNA base pairs, for every 15 and a half base pairs that you add to a person's telomeres, you're effectively adding a year to their life expectancy. Okay, so 15.5 base pairs equals one extra year, according to this biological aging construct that in population-based studies, these associations are clear. So fiber. They did a study in the United States. It's our national survey called the NHANES survey. They looked at dietary patterns and telomeres, and they were controlling for a number of different factors like smoking and body mass index and all these different things. And what they discovered was quite profound, and I would actually argue shocking. To me, this is shocking. Like, even to me as a big fiber guy, I'm like taken aback by this. So basically what they found is that for every 1,000 calories in your diet, for every 1,000 calories that you consume, if you just added 1 gram of fiber, one stinking gram, it would add 8.3 base pairs to your telomeres.
Wow.
So to do the math, basically what they're saying is if you, for every 1,000 calories that you consume during your life, if you just added one stinking gram of fiber, you are adding more than a half of a year to your life expectancy.
It's extraordinary.
And if you, you know, multiply it out and you add 10 grams, then you're adding 5 years onto your life expectancy. And we think the reason why goes back to the short-chain fatty acids. We believe that the short-chain fatty acids help to prevent the deconstruction of these telomeres. There is some research that I was referring to in FiberFueled, which I mostly wrote in 2019. So it's like basically research that's up to date through 2019. There has been some research that I would love to see reproduced, but that basically they found that on a plant-based diet, you can actually lengthen the telomeres on individual people. So it's quite fascinating.
So I guess from my reading, we could say the day job as such of our microbes is to help us to digest our food. But they do so much more than that in terms of changing the expression of our genetic code. And obviously 70 to 80% of our immune cells in our body reside in our guts. And we recently, Fee and I, recorded an episode on the role of the immune system in cancer, which is to date one of my favorite episodes we've done. Could you help us understand a little more about the role the gut plays in the development of serious systemic diseases like cancer, as well as in how our gut can alter gene expression? And again, if we're relating all of it back together, how these things, the gut, the immune system, and cancer all marry up.
We could literally do an entire episode on this topic, but I think that the tie that binds these things together are the short-chain fatty acids. That's where our diet and our microbes intersect to create something that affects our gut barrier and our immune system and other parts of our body. So the short-chain fatty acids become the key. And if we start with a basic conception, by the way, this is going to be an oversimplification. So for physicians who are listening, I apologize. Cancer is out of control cellular growth, right? And there's no break. It's just a runaway train. And typically the body has brakes that are in place to help to stop this from happening. And one of the ways that we can activate that brake, slow it down, and allow the body to identify that there's a problem is actually with butyrate. Butyrate has the ability through these receptors, HDAC receptors, that allow butyrate to basically slow down this process and prevent the cellular turnover and the out of control growth. It also helps to identify the cell for targeting by the immune system. And in a separate area, like not the exact same thing, the butyrate or the short-chain fatty acids are actually affecting the ability of the immune system to target, whether it be cancer cells or a virus. We now have overwhelming evidence that short-chain fatty acids allow us to do this. And that includes both in the cancer world and simultaneously in the infectious world, such as the data that have emerged during COVID. With cancer, my favorite example of this, because I think that this is where the research is most far along, and then I'll provide some supporting to this, but my most interesting area is with melanoma. Melanoma is the most dangerous skin cancers. Dr. Sophie can speak with more clarity on this. I would love for her to, by the way, jump in on anything that she wants to add to. But basically, with melanoma, there was a change that occurred during my professional career where we shifted towards, rather than directly attacking the melanoma itself, there's been a shift towards what's called immunotherapy, where actually we're empowering the immune system, our own immune system, to attack the cancer cells for us. Now, the research that I'm about to share is out of MD Anderson in the United States, one of our top three cancer centers. And there's a sequence of studies that lead up to the sort of sweet story here, which is that first, they noticed that people who took antibiotics did not do as well with immunotherapy for melanoma. And they thought maybe this is just that they're sicker, because it's true, sicker people require antibiotics more likely. So maybe that's the reason why they didn't do so well. But then they actually did a clinical trial looking at this, and discovered that by randomizing people to receive antibiotics, they discovered, oh no, like this is real. What do antibiotics do? They destroy the microbiome. So then they said, well, what's the alternative here? They said, well, we could give a fecal transplant. So they did a small pilot study looking at fecal transplant in people who had failed. They had failed immunotherapy for their melanoma. And they refreshed their microbiome by giving them a new microbiome through fecal transplant. And a large percentage of these people went on to basically have great outcomes with regard to their melanoma. So like completely different results the second time around because of the fecal transplant.
That's extraordinary, because melanoma, as you say, the shift in approach to melanoma has gone, it's still a very serious cancer and one of the ones that, you know, strikes fear into many people's hearts, but the outcomes have really, really changed. And to know that something, and I use the word simple because it isn't simple, it's also extremely complex, but something like just rebalancing your microbiome can so profoundly influence your outcomes is amazing.
Sophie, it gets even more simple, which is that we can just add fiber to our diet. So they followed this up because they said, oh, wow, we have this fecal transplant thing. That's cool. But what about the average person who's not getting a fecal transplant? What happens if they consume more fiber? Here's what they found. This is, by the way, retrospective data, so that it needs to be verified in prospective clinical trials. But I think they're in the process of doing that. Basically, they found that for every 5 grams of fiber in your diet, 5 grams, like the amount that you get from a half of a cup of beans, people increase their likelihood of survival with melanoma by 30%. Now, this is in parallel and mirrors data that we have seen with both colorectal cancer and breast cancer. I mentioned earlier in the show that my favorite fiber study by Andrew Reynolds showed that people can prevent colorectal and breast cancer by increasing their fiber intake. And now here I am and I'm saying, if you have been diagnosed with colorectal or breast cancer, you can increase your likelihood of survival by increasing your fiber intake after treatment.
This is astonishing. And can I also just chime in and say, I heard you mention, Will, that it was discovered that cancer cells have their own microbiome. That blows my mind.
Yeah. Well, I think that the thing that we need to realize, like when we hear stuff like this, that a tumor has its own microbiome, by the way, that microbiome, the state of that microbiome actually has been tied to treatment outcomes. So, I mean, this is quite shocking to hear this. And I think that the realization that we need to have is that we think of the world as if poop is not sterile, but most of our world is sterile. That's not true. Everything that's alive on this planet, everything that's alive, either has a microbiome or is a part of the microbiome. And depending on how we want to zoom in or zoom out, you could make an argument that humans are part of the global microbiome or like global ecosystem of this planet, right? And you could zoom in all the way to a microscopic level and see that a tumor has its own microbiome and that determines what happens with that tumor. Microbes are everywhere.
Well, this is a bit of a swerve, but I think it's really interesting. And that's the link between gut health and sex. Our listenership is primarily female. I'm a woman, and I am fascinated to know how different our gut ecosystem is from the ecosystem in our vaginas.
They are quite different. There is one moment in human life where they start to overlap and become very similar. And I find this fascinating. I'm the father of four children. Very grateful to my wife for bearing these children. And late in the third trimester of pregnancy, the vaginal microbiome undergoes a shift and starts to resemble a woman's gut microbiome.
Wow.
Which is fascinating to me because basically what that's saying is it's preparing for the birth of the child. And when the child is born, traditionally, the child passes through the birth canal. And in the process of doing so, receives its first exposure to the microbial world in which this child will exist for the rest of their life. And this is the reason why a vaginal delivery has been demonstrated to be protective from a number of different both metabolic and immune-related health conditions. So to me, that's like the one moment, quite fascinating, but the vaginal microbiome compared to the gut microbiome is much more simple. Not quite as diverse, does include some similar types of families of microbes, and they're not completely independent. Much like the skin microbiome is not completely independent of the gut microbiome. These things are tethered together on some level, and the reason that we know this is because you can do things to manipulate the gut microbiome that will result in changes in the vaginal microbiome. An example of that is probiotics.
I was really fascinated to hear you talk about depression as an inflammatory disorder and about how trauma shows up in our gut. Can you tell us a bit more about the correlation between gut and our cognitive functions, so mood, memory, and even ADHD?
Yeah, it's an entire talk. It could be like literally multiple podcasts, could be an entire book, but the point with this is understanding what we call the gut-brain connection, which is that our gut is constantly communicating to our brain, and our brain is constantly communicating back to our gut. And things that affect one will affect both. So with mood disorders, I don't want to make it sound like mood disorders are a pure gut phenomenon. We don't know that. We don't know that's true. What we do see is this. We do see that if you were to take people who have, for example, major depression, this is, you know, diagnosed and quite intense mood disorder. If you were to take that person and take a look at their gut microbiome, you would see that there's dysbiosis. And there would be microbes that are missing. And the microbes that are missing are the ones that produce short-chain fatty acids. I keep coming back to the same themes because these themes are so powerful. And the short-chain fatty acids, like, it really does appear like the short-chain fatty acids are the key in terms of influencing brain architecture on a number of different levels. And one of the key ways that they do this that I find to be quite fascinating is that I mentioned earlier, like particularly when we were talking about the alcohol that we have, the gut barrier is a single layer of cells that separates our intestines from our bloodstream and our immune system. And this single layer of cells, it's very important. And it's held together by these proteins called tight junctions that basically like secure it, seal it. And the short chain fatty acids, particularly butyrate, are what maintain those tight junctions to keep our gut barrier intact, our gut barrier. But we have a blood-brain barrier too. And it turns out, and like Sophie, I didn't learn this in medical school.
No, None of this is taught to us in medical school.
Yeah. So, but we have a blood-brain barrier too. I mean, I heard about the blood-brain barrier clearly, but what I wasn't taught is that it's conceptually very similar to the gut barrier. And the proteins that hold together the cells of the blood-brain barrier are exactly the same. It's the tight junctions. It's the exact same protein. And so it's quite fascinating to consider, for example, people who may come into a doctor's office and say, I have brain fog. Well, clearly brain fog exists. There are like literally thousands of people out there who are saying that they experience this. But doctors struggle with this because they don't really know what to make of it. So sometimes they roll their eyes because we as doctors are taught that we're supposed to always have answers. So if we don't know, then we roll our eyes because it must not be us. It's an unfortunate thing. But anyway, the blood-brain barrier, I think, is the issue here. They don't have leaky gut. They have leaky brain. And that blood-brain barrier, because it's not doing its job, is allowing toxins to actually get access to the brain that aren't supposed to be there. How can we repair and restore that? The answer, again, is the short-chain fatty acids. The short-chain fatty acids help to activate those tight junctions so that we can restore competence to the blood-brain barrier. And so there have been a number of different situations where this appears to be true, whether that be major depression or other mood disorders, whether that be Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, migraine headaches. There's a number of different neurologic conditions where this is true. And one last thing before I go on the whole gut-brain axis, there's a new study that just came out less than a month ago that I want to bring forward. So we have known for a very long time that there's this connection between the gut and Parkinson's disease. All people with Parkinson's disease are constipated.
That's interesting.
All of them, 100%. That's interesting. And when they've started to dig into this, looking at prospective data, where they could actually identify what came first, consultation with your gastroenterologist or diagnosis of Parkinson's, they found that actually the gut symptoms were detectable prior to the onset of the Parkinson's symptoms. They think that it's initiated in the gut first. Now, by the way, I just want to reassure the listeners, if you have constipation, it does not mean in any way that you're going to develop Parkinson's disease. Okay, this is a fraction. But they think that the gut symptoms come first. Okay, so here's what we just found out less than a month ago. There was a human clinical trial published looking at fecal transplant, and they did a single fecal transplant in people who already have diagnosed Parkinson's disease. One single fecal transplant. And it was durable for a year. They had an entire year where the physical symptoms of Parkinson's disease improved. That doesn't mean they went medication free. I'm not saying there was a cure. What I'm saying is there was improvement of the physical symptoms of Parkinson's disease for an entire year by getting one fecal transplant. Fascinating.
It is. It's fascinating. It's compelling. And I love the fact, actually, that you keep coming back to the same place, which is gut health, fiber, short-chain fatty acids. I actually like the fact that we're simplifying it in that way. Can we talk about, you've mentioned fecal transplants, and I think it would be good to move on to what is probably one of the biggest taboos, and that's our toilet habits. How often should we be pooping, and what should our poop look and feel like? And please explain to our listeners the Bristol stool chart, because I love hearing you talk about this.
So first of all, my apologies. My wife has informed me, because I'm not aware of it, that I'm far too comfortable talking openly about poop.
Do you know, I still remember the first time I brought up gangrene over the dinner table with my family. I think this is a medic thing. We sometimes lose insight.
Yeah, I know. No, I quite openly do this. And then my kids will like get in trouble at school for talking about poop. And I'm like, it's my fault. I did this to them. So anyway, I personally, look, I'm a gastroenterologist. I'm quite biased here, but like I feel like it's this as you mentioned, it's this taboo topic that we're not supposed to or allowed to talk about. Yet, if gut health matters, which I hope by this point in the podcast, you're still here listening to us, you must believe. I certainly do. I certainly believe that gut health matters. And if that's the case, then what are the ways in which we can measure and understand our gut health? And if I were a cardiologist, like if I were Sophie and I were a dermatologist, you look at the skin. I was actually taught by dermatologists, stop asking questions, just look at the skin. In cardiology, you would listen to the heart. And in gastroenterology, you would look in the toilet bowl. I don't know how I ended up in this career. But This is somehow I ended up in this place through a sequence of choices. But anyway, and the reason why is because our poop is the most clear window into what's happening with our digestive system. When our digestive system falls out of balance, then we run into issues. And that could be diarrhea, could be constipation. Either way, typically where this is going to manifest is actually in the way that we poop and what that poop looks like. And so you can start to use this as an insight. And the other part of this that's really important is to understand that I used to think, even after I graduated medical school, that poop was just the excrement of our food. You eat and whatever you don't absorb, it comes out.
Most people think that.
That's not actually true. It turns out that 60% of the weight of our poop are microbes.
Wow.
So our poop is mostly reflective of our microbiome. There are people who actually, they have their intestines surgically, like there are reasons, for example, Crohn's disease, where a person might actually like have an ostomy and not have food pass through their colon. Yet they still need to poop sometimes because their microbes are producing that. So anyway, the point is that this is a window into our microbiome, and we have shown that clearly the way in which your poop looks is associated with changes to your microbiome. And the way in which your poop looks can be classified. This is a bit of a weird thing. At first, I was like, oh man, who's this Bristol person? I feel bad for him. Not a Bristol person. It's all the people from Bristol. They did a study back in the 90s. And basically, from this study that was done in the 90s of about 2,000 people, they created what's called the Bristol stool chart. And it's seven specific pictures that are different shapes or forms of your stool that can vary from rabbit pellets that are really hard all the way up to just watery diarrhea. And these seven different types give you an idea where you are and what's happening. And what I'm here to tell you is that it's not just constipation or diarrhea. It also is a window into your microbiome. And that's why our poop matters. We should be looking at it.
You talked a bit about constipation. And can you talk a bit more about the link with magnesium? Because talking about supplements and their roles is one of my favorites for nearly everyone. So I'm keen to hear what your thoughts are around that with constipation.
Well, so magnesium is a quite fascinating mineral. It's involved in, I don't even recall the exact number, over 100 different bodily functions. And that includes the way in which our intestines function. And it's my experience, at least in the States, granted this is just my experience, but my experience is that many people, even when they have a healthful diet, are still magnesium deficient. They don't get enough magnesium in their diet. And with constipation, it's not just a magnesium deficiency and it's not just magnesium repletion that fixes the issue. The role of magnesium is that it helps to actually draw water into the intestines. So we call this an osmotic laxative. And so there's specific types of magnesium that you would want to use in order to do this. The ones that you want are magnesium oxide, magnesium citrate, or magnesium sulfate. I've had a lot of people who are like, but I use magnesium gluconate or magnesium threonate. And the problem is like those are great for sleep, great for mood, but not very helpful for pooping. But anyway, magnesium, when we take an adequate amount, typically in supplement form, it actually helps us to have a good bowel movement. And so it can be a non-medication alternative that can really help our constipation. It pairs and complements fiber really well. Fiber adds bulk to the stool. Magnesium draws the water in. So the cumulative effect between the two is that basically you're floating the log down the river. That's a beautiful thing. So bottom line, magnesium, to me, like not this, look, constipation is a nuanced topic, but for many people who have constipation, if they did a magnesium supplement, typically 500 to 1,000 milligrams per day in combination with a fiber supplement, it helps to address their issue. Please talk to your doctor about this. Don't just hear it on the podcast. And usually you want to make sure that's safe, but like you can check your magnesium level before and after just to make sure everything's fine.
Yeah. And we'll put all of this in the show notes so people can go and take a look. And as you say, they must consult with their own GP or doctor. But what do you think about stool tests or the SIBO test? And or are there any tests that you'd recommend to get a really good idea of our unique microbiomes and bacterial diversity?
Okay, so I'm quite biased because I'm the US medical director of ZOE. And now, to be clear, ZOE is not exclusively a microbiome test. ZOE is an entire kit that includes a microbiome specimen, but also includes blood sugar analysis, blood fat analysis, things that you enter into the app, a standardized meal. I do get a bit defensive on this topic because I myself am not a fan of microbiome tests unless they are validated. But with ZOE, I do feel that we have taken the appropriate steps to validate, like far beyond way from any other company. We are publishing papers in Nature Medicine, literally showing that our product works. So if we could take the ZOE, which I'm happy to talk about further, but let's put that to the side for a moment because I don't think that's what you're trying to get at. Regular stool tests, regular just microbiome tests, I have not found them to be very helpful. The reason why is because you can tell a person what microbes exist and you can say, well, generally speaking, these microbes are good or these microbes are bad. But the problem is that doesn't help us to give advice to that individual person. You're making it up. Like anyone who says otherwise, I don't know what to tell you, but there's no study that shows that by using, other than the things that we've done with ZOE, there's no study showing that by using the microbiome test, that you're going to change a person's health outcomes. Mm. And so that to me is where because they can be very expensive. Like in the States, I can just speak for the States because this is what I've come across. People often spend $600 on this. So to me, keep that money, look in the toilet bowl. That'll tell you just as much, if not more. SIBO tests, we could do an entire episode on this. The short answer with SIBO is that we have to be very careful because the tests that exist right now, specifically the breath test, is wildly flawed. So if we just line up 100 people and start SIBO breath testing them, we're going to find some people that says yes, we're going to find some people that says no, but it's not reliable information. So we have to be very thoughtful and cautious in the way that we approach this question because SIBO is real, but making the diagnosis is not so easy as just running the test because the test is not reliable.
Where do you stand on fecal transplants? And I know we've talked about them a little bit in this episode, and I think I probably know which side of the fence you're coming down on, but can you explain a bit of the thinking behind them to our listeners?
I mean, I think where we are today with fecal transplants, it's exciting to consider the possibility of what may happen in the future, but we're not there yet. There's one specific area where fecal transplants are proven and actually like incredibly helpful. And that is people that have an infection called Clostridioides difficile, C. diff. And the short on this, it's an infection. So if you can clear the infection, then it's over. And the problem was that 15 years ago, we couldn't clear the infection with antibiotics. We had people literally losing their colon or dying until we started using fecal transplants. And it turns out, because this is a colon infection, it's quite fascinating to ponder this, that when you take someone who has a rip-roaring, raging colon infection that's life-threatening, and you quite simply restore a healthy microbiome, the vast majority of the time, that person is better within 48 hours.
48 hours, wow.
It's impressive.
Yeah, it's almost instantaneous. It's quite fascinating, and I've done it many times throughout my career. This is where, from a actual clinical perspective, we're limited. This is the only way that fecal transplants should be used in terms of right now, from a clinical perspective. These other studies that we see, such as with cancer, such as with Parkinson's disease, there's many more. We're not yet ready for prime time, so we need to continue to study them. Clinical trials is where we're doing that.
I have several questions in one, so I'll try and put it into one main question, which is supplements. And in fact, let's talk about your range of supplements, 38 Tera. Have I pronounced that correctly? Because I wanted to ask you what you think about probiotics and also steer people onto our previous gut health episode where Dr. Sophie talks about probiotics. Sophie's got a lot of interesting stuff to say on that. But in terms of your view on probiotics and 38 Tera, and in fact, anything else in your stack, any biohacking, what do you think about supplements? And tell us more about 38 Tera.
Yeah, so I mentioned earlier that I believe that supplements are a complementary piece. Like, you shouldn't be changing your diet because of supplements. You shouldn't say, well, I get my fiber from a supplement, therefore I don't need to get it in my diet. That's not the way that we approach this. Mm-hmm. You optimize your diet, you optimize your lifestyle, you add your supplements to complement that. And I'm of the belief, because like, you'll never be able to convince me otherwise, because I spent 10 years watching people change their lives using supplements in my clinic. I'm of the belief that these can be a massively important part of what we do. In fact, I've seen people who have a very healthy diet. And because supplements are not the same as diet, you can add, for example, a prebiotic fiber supplement and change the results for that person, radically improve their gut health, because it's not exactly the same. So the key is, from my perspective, is the fact that we are all unique individuals. So we need things that acknowledge that. And the challenge with probiotics, do probiotics work? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure there are listeners who will raise their hand right now and be like, yeah, they worked for me. They helped me. Do for some people, they not work? Yeah, same would be true. I'm sure listeners are like, yeah, but I tried them and they didn't work. The key here is that we have to find the right probiotic for the right person to address a specific issue. So there's not this one probiotic that's going to fix all of our health problems all at once. That's a joke. That's not real. What there is there are specific probiotics for specific issues, and you introduce them into your life and you make an honest assessment of whether or not they've improved your health for the reason that you're taking them. And if they do, you know that it's helping and it's meshing well with your gut microbiome, which is highly unique. But flip side, a probiotic could have the most amazing randomized control trial to show that it works for almost everyone. But if you start taking it for that specific purpose and it doesn't help you, why are you taking it? You should stop. So this is the way that I approach trying to find and acknowledge our own personal microbiome. This is the way that I approach that issue. Prebiotics, which are things like fiber and resistant starch and polyphenols, it's a little bit different because your gut will adapt to the prebiotic. So you don't need to have the right sort of conditions for that prebiotic to do something. The prebiotic will do something. It just will take time for your gut to adapt to it. And recognizing that 95% of people in the United States are not consuming an adequate amount of fiber. By the way, that's about 90% in the UK. Recognizing that the average, for example, resistant starch intake on a daily basis in the US is 4 grams, and it would be better off if it were 15 or 20. Recognizing that like 80 to 90% of people don't eat enough fruits and vegetables, and that's where our polyphenols come from. Like, to me, this is part of the way in which we can start to close this gap and address these issues, is with supplements that do that. And so anyway, to answer your question, 38 Terra, we launched in January of this year. This is a 3-year project that I've been working on, basically to create the products that I thought should be out already. And when we launched, we were available for shipping to the UK, and I was not satisfied with the quality of the service that we were able to provide to people, because we were shipping internationally. It drove up the costs. Mm. It was not reliable. So the bottom line is that we are planning to come to the UK and to the EU. But it does take us some time to get the proper systems in place so that I can, because I believe that we have a really phenomenal product and I think the service should match that. And so it's going to take me a little bit of time to get it there. So that's what we're working on right now.
You talked a bit there about prebiotics as well. And I think it's really useful to just touch on this, because so many people now talk about probiotics, which is great, brilliant that they're recognizing it. But obviously, prebiotics and postbiotics are also important. And I think it might be really helpful for people to understand a little bit more about that.
So prebiotics, like if I were to simplify, it's food for your microbes. So this is how we empower the microbes, right? Like if we don't eat, we're not really good at what we do. They're the same. If they don't eat, they're not that great. But when you feed them, they become strong and they're able to do their job. Probiotics are the actual microbes. To be a probiotic, you have to be beneficial to human health. So you can't be like one of the bad guys and be called a probiotic. And then postbiotics are what are produced by the microbes. Imagine that we want to prepare the most delicious meal, the most fantastically delicious meal. We want to prepare that. What do we need? We need the ingredients. Those are the prebiotics. We need the chefs. Those are the probiotics. And when you give the chef the proper ingredients, that chef will prepare the most delicious meal, serve it on the plate, and those are the postbiotics. The postbiotics are what actually matter. That's what is bioactive. That's what is actually transforming our health. Throughout this conversation, we've talked about short-chain fatty acids. Those are the postbiotics, but they're not the only one. So the formula, quite simply, is prebiotics, the ingredients, probiotics, the chef, equals postbiotics. We basically have control over the probiotics and the prebiotics. We control those two things. Those are levers that we can pull to basically create the outcome that we want, which is more postbiotics, and then reap the rewards that come from that. It's, to me, that's even more powerful than a breathing exercise.
I feel like we're just touching the surface on so many topics here that we could have gone into multiple podcasts, and we've taken lots of your time, Dr. Will. We've taken lots of your time. Thank you.
Thank you as well.
And that ends our podcast. If you want to explore more of what we talked about, simply head to the show notes. We've done all of the research and noting down of names, ideas, any studies we mentioned, so you don't have to go digging. To be ahead of the latest episode, press follow on Apple Podcasts. That's the little cross on the top right. Or simply hit follow on Spotify or whichever podcast app you use. Also, do follow Sophie on Instagram and TikTok. There's loads of great content and little explainers on there. Search for Dr. Sophie Schotter. Finally, if you're close to London or Kent, you can book a consultation with Sophie and find out more about who she is and the range of treatments and services she offers via drsophieschotter.com. And by the way, there's some great blog content on the website too. My name's Fiona Mattesini. On behalf of myself and Sophie, please do take a moment to rate and review the show. It all helps. And of course, thanks for listening.